Today is Wednesday, June 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up,
there will be an impact on the price of goods coming back and forth between the United States and Mexico that is going to raise prices on consumers, it's going to cost American jobs, and frankly, it's going to hurt my farmers, to be very blunt with you.
U.S. lawmakers criticize President Trump's latest tariff tactic aimed at Mexico. Also ahead, today starts worldwide ceremonies commemorating D-Day. And a new Freedom House report says press freedom is deteriorating worldwide. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. President Donald Trump joined British Prime Minister Theresa May, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, and other leaders today for a D-Day commemoration ceremony in the British city of Portsmouth. The event included musical performances and historical readings, including Trump reciting a prayer that former U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt read to those listening on the radio after the start of the 1944 invasion. May's office released a statement highlighting the historic international cooperation involved in the massive operation to land forces across the English Channel in Normandy, France, as Allied militaries worked to defeat Nazi Germany. Britain's Queen Elizabeth also took part in the commemorations, including visiting with D-Day veterans along with Trump. Well, as 300 aging D-Day veterans, all now in their 90s, listened, Trump did recite, as we mentioned, a prayer President Franklin D. Roosevelt delivered on radio D-Day, including the wartime president's professed belief in the virtue of the invasion. Associated Press reporter Matt Small has more.
Among the things President Trump will see on the southern coast of England with other world leaders is testimony from some of the more than 300 World War II veterans in what's being billed as one of the greatest British military spectacles in recent years, featuring a flyby of 24 vintage and modern military aircraft. Today's event begins 2 days of D-Day anniversary observances, which are intended to be a tribute to the soldiers who shaped history during the dangerous mission to reach beachheads and fight in German-occupied France. I'm Matt Small.
Well, as we continue our reporting on D-Day, 75 years ago, thousands of American troops were preparing to take part in D-Day when Allied forces crossed the English Channel from Britain to invade German-occupied France on the beaches of Normandy. They faced ferocious resistance, but Operation Overlord, as it was known, was ultimately successful, and Nazi Germany fell 11 months later. Several D-Day veterans have returned to Normandy for the anniversary. Henry Ridgewell spoke at length to one Tennessee veteran who was injured 3 times in the battle to retake France.
Age has left its mark. The battle scars have slowed them, but their determination is undimmed. At Omaha Beach Monday, a group of Second World War veterans came to see and to remember. Among them were 3 men who took part in the first wave of D-Day landings on June 6, 1944. Russell Pickett was then a 19-year-old soldier with the 116th Infantry Regiment. With a flamethrower strapped to his back, his landing craft approached Omaha Beach.
Our force hadn't bombed our beach like they were supposed to, so we'd have some holes to get in, you know, so we couldn't come in like sitting ducks. I couldn't stand up because I was afraid a bullet might hit the flamethrower. Our boat blowed the best a few yards before we would touch down. I woke up with laying on the sand with her feet in the water. And I couldn't, my legs wouldn't work, so I don't know really how I got in there, but something's way or another.
Over 4,000 Allied soldiers died on D-Day itself. German losses are estimated at 4,000 to 9,000. Pickett was rescued by another landing craft just as the tide was about to pull him out to sea.
He had about 4 more on there. Well, one that was got his whole shoulder blowed out. He died on the way back to the ship. They so took me back to the ship and took me back to England. And by the time I got to England, I could walk, you know, fairly well, hopping about on my right ride. And So I came back when that same ship brought me back when he loaded, and I was back with the outfit in about 6 days and stayed with them then until St. Lo. They got me at St. Lo and carried me back to England again, 21 days that time, and come back again. They put me out up at Brest in September, the last part of September. It was 2 days before Brest gigged up that they carried me out on stretchers that time, so I couldn't come back.
Pickett was sent home to Tennessee in June 1945. Many of his brothers in arms never made it back.
Believe it or not, I tried to blank some of the thinking out, so remembering all of my buddies that was killed and that's buried in the cemetery up here. So you can imagine many friends, and I take a dry mouth. I can't really explain how I feel. I'm glad I'm here, but that's being my last trip.
Around 35 American D-Day veterans have traveled to Normandy this year, alongside dozens of fellow vets from Britain, Canada, and several other nations.
With each anniversary that passes, the number of D-Day veterans still alive sadly gets smaller. And with their passing, the world also loses the first-hand accounts of the battles that happened on these beaches and the extraordinary events of 75 years ago that would change the course of the war and of history itself. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, Omaha Beach, Normandy.
Among the top stories in the world, more than 2,000 cases of the Ebola virus have hit the DRC. The younger sister of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un reappears in public for the first time in more than 50 days amid questions about her status and whether she and other prominent officials have been purged. And authorities in India launch an operation to retrieve the bodies of five missing climbers believed to have been killed in an avalanche on a notoriously dangerous Himalayan mountain. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
Sleep deprivation has long been linked with having a higher risk for cardiovascular disease and even death from coronary heart disease. A study published in the journal Psychosomatic Medicine suggests one possible reason is that having a bad night of sleep can cause blood pressure to spike. The researchers studied 300 men and women between the ages of 21 and 70 with no history of heart problems. The participants wore portable blood pressure cuffs and had their blood pressure randomly measured over a two-day, two-night period. To gauge their sleep efficiency, they also wore devices that measured movement as they slept. The researchers found that the participants with lower sleep efficiency readings also showed an increase in blood pressure during the night and a higher systolic or upper number blood pressure the following day. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Well, U.S. and Mexican officials warn that raising tariffs on Mexican goods to get Mexico to stem the influx of Central American migrants on the way to the U.S. border would hurt the economics of both countries. U.S. President Donald Trump has threatened to apply tariffs of 5% on all Mexican goods starting June 10th and increase the rate in coming months to up to 25% if Mexico does not substantially halt the migrants heading to the U.S. border. Mexican officials say U.S. tariffs would harm the economy and do little to reduce migration. Some U.S. lawmakers agree. VOA's Zlatica Hoke has more.
The U.S. state of Texas and Mexico share more than 2,000 kilometers of common border and are connected by international bridges and roads. Their economies depend on a strong trading relationship, Senator John Cornyn of Texas said Monday in Washington.
It's important to remember that any actions that we take to secure our southern border must also keep in mind the important role that Mexico plays in the economy of the United States.
Cornyn said the migration problem is a result of faulty U.S. asylum laws and that the issue needs to be addressed as soon as possible. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said the Trump administration exacerbated the crisis on the U.S. southern border by cutting aid to Central American countries.
It's a completely self-inflicted wound to our national security that makes the problems the president complains about worse, not better.
Meanwhile, a high delegation from Mexico made its case against Trump's tariffs at a press conference in Washington.
Mexico has been working to address the increase of migration, offering the option to apply for refugee status, adapting the legal framework to offer regional work permits for those who choose to stay, or those who seek to work in the southern Mexican states, and also boosting migration control along the southern Mexican border.
Mexican Foreign Minister Marcelo Ebrard argued that without those actions, there would be 250,000 more migrants at the U.S. border this year. He said imposing tariffs on Mexican goods and canceling aid programs for Central America would not reduce migration flows, but increase them. Mexico's agriculture minister explained the impact of the tariffs for both sides of the border.
If this tariff is imposed, the impact it would have on agriculture would be around $1.4 billion. This is approximately $3.8 million daily, which would impact both sides of the border, particularly the consumer.
Mexican officials said the United States and Mexico have to hold talks with countries whose people are fleeing, notably El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, with the goal of reducing the main causes of migration, crime, poverty, and violence. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA's International Edition.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
Well, the death toll from attacks on protesters by Sudanese security forces has risen to 60, doctors linked to the protesters say. Hundreds of wounded are recovering in hospitals and homes across the city. But hospitals themselves have become targets, with gunmen surrounding healthcare centers and at times attempting to enter the facilities. Reporter Jason Patinkin gained rare access to one hospital and reports from Khartoum.
Details are emerging on what appears to have been a brutal, coordinated assault on protesters in central Khartoum and those who tried to help the wounded. Sudan's ruling Transitional Military Council has claimed that security forces that raided the main protest site Monday only moved on criminal elements among the protesters. But survivors at Royal Care Hospital being treated for wounds told another story. Witnesses who spoke to reporters Tuesday blamed the attacks on the notorious Rapid Support Forces, a militia from Darfur led by Transitional Military Council's deputy chief, Mohamed Hamdan Daglo. Police officers have also been accused of taking part in the assault, but witnesses said they were RSF troops wearing police uniforms based on their accents and behavior. Sitting in a wheelchair, Berdat Khadir said the RSF attacked once the regular army, who previously defended protesters, had left or were unarmed. He says they started attacking people once they knew that the army was no longer able to fight back. They were godless. They had no souls, says Khadir. These people are not Sudanese. We don't accept them among us. Even the dead, they were beating the dead who were on the ground, he says. 25-year-old student Mahmoud Abdullah showed bruises all over his back and shoulders, and his right arm was in a sling. He said after the RSF chased them from the streets, he hid with other students in Khartoum University's dormitories within the protest site. They, the RSF, told us to come out, but when we didn't come out, says Abdullah, they threw tear gas inside and then pointed their weapons at us. I opened the door to let them in, and they slapped me on both sides of the head, he says. I fell to the ground and they started beating me, says Abdullah. There were maybe 25 of them, hitting me with sticks, whips, the butts of their guns, whatever. Abdullah fled to a clinic, where he says he passed out, only to wake up to troops entering. They beat the clinic people, asking, why are you helping him, says Abdullah. They broke the arm of one of the clinic staff. They were whipped for trying to help me, he says. This is the ugliest human treatment possible. Witnesses at Royal Care Hospital say troops attacked again on Tuesday morning, firing on the medical facility as it was treating wounded protesters. Mohammed Ibrahim said he was inside the hospital with his father when he saw machine gun-mounted pickup trucks arrive and point their weapons at people who had gathered to support the wounded. They assaulted both revolutionaries and doctors, he says. We tried to get outside of the hospital, but we couldn't get out. I saw shooting at the entrance of the hospital and one doctor injured, says Ibrahim, so we laid on the ground. The glass windows at Royal Care Hospital are tinted, he says, so they might not have been able to see us, but it's glass, says Ibrahim, so we laid down below a concrete wall to block the bullets. The RSF returned to the hospital as reporters inside were interviewing the wounded. As the troops surrounded the building, staff and patients quickly switched off the lights and hid in locked closets and bathrooms. Many relatives and friends of wounded protesters and other patients fled the hospital for fear of another attack. But 21-year-old Saha Omar said she couldn't leave her father, who was waiting for brain surgery.
We hide inside the hospital, in the room. The hospital staff asked us to stay in the room with every patient and not to leave our rooms. I'm very worried. Fear is that they're going to come into the hospital and start just shooting, because no one can stop them. There is really nothing that can stop them right now.
One volunteer bringing food to wounded protesters, who did not wish to be named, said patients would suffer if the harassment continued.
There is no staff can reach the hospital. The doctors or other staff cannot reach to the hospital. We are now trying to call the doctors, and we have a lot of cases. Open fractures need an urgent operation, but doctors cannot reach to the hospital.
With even hospitals coming under attack, it seems nowhere is safe in Sudan's capital from the security crackdown. Jason Patinkin for VOA News, Khartoum.
This is VOA's International Edition. A new Freedom House report says press freedom is deteriorating worldwide. VOA's Ramon Taylor reports.
Authoritarian figures who work to undermine independent journalism continue to consolidate power. But among fragile democracies, new tactics are also emerging, according to a new report on freedom and the media. The watchdog organization Freedom House says a danger lies in China's globalizing influence, including efforts to harness media across Africa. Sarah Rapucci is Senior Director for Research and Analysis at Freedom House.
They're doing it by exporting their message and finding friendly outlets that will publish and broadcast that message. They're doing it by putting pressure on journalists, but also diplomats and media owners in countries to censor, basically on Beijing's behalf.
According to Freedom House, the bleak outlook for global media freedom is the result of worsening records across the map, alongside the rise of right-wing populism. Classified as the two least free regions in the world, Eurasia and Middle East North Africa saw their average press freedom scores decline by 9% and 11% respectively since 2014. But also contributing to the overall global decline is Europe, where 4 out of every 5 countries are free. However, Europe's average press freedom score dropped 8%. Freedom House reports that a total of 16 nations designated as free have seen a reduction in press freedom scores during that five-year span. Sarah Rapucci, the report's lead author, says the United States, which Freedom House labels the world's leading democratic power, maintains strong legal protections in the face of threats and attacks against individual media outlets.
The major news media have been really strong in pushing back against these attacks and in continuing to publish information that holds leaders to account. But the concern is that norms may be changing and that it will be difficult to get back to where we were before.
I have ammunition that has been going on for like almost a minute.
In troubled media environments like Sudan and Venezuela, Rapucci maintains that social media, despite its flaws, continues to play an outsized role as a lifeline to journalists and to democracy as a whole. Ramon Taylor, VOA News, New York.
Well, activists marking World Environment Day are calling for action to tackle air pollution, which researchers say kills millions of people every year and impoverishes societies struggling to reduce its harmful effects. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
We Are Walking On is a World Environment Day song inspired by childhood memories of a Japanese town fighting air pollution and winning. The young enthusiastic performers express their love for the environment. Through their artistry, they hope to raise awareness of the dangers threatening the planet and to promote action to preserve its natural beauty. The World Health Organization considers air pollution the world's largest single environmental health risk, killing about 7 million people every year. Millions more suffer long-term health problems, such as asthma, stroke, lung cancer, and heart disease. The World Bank estimates the global economic cost of breathing in dirty air at more than $5 trillion every year. Executive Secretary of the UN Economic Commission for Europe, Olga Algayarova, calls the human and economic costs arising from air pollution staggering. But she says her agency has shown that effective action can be taken to combat this scourge. In 1979, she notes 51 countries in Europe and North America signed the UNECE Convention on Long-Range Transboundary Air Pollution, familiarly known as the Air Convention.
For instance, emissions of harmful substances, including particulate matters and sulfur, have been cut by 30 to 80% since 1990 in Europe and 30 to 40% in North America. People in Europe live 12 months longer due to our Air Convention.
The one additional year of life expectancy gained by reducing air pollution, she says, is preventing 600,000 premature deaths annually in the European region. Algayarova notes the Air Convention is the only regional policy solution of this kind. Thanks to its success, she says other regions are looking to UNECE for advice on how they too can act to reduce air pollution. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thank you, Lisa. Well, the trade war between the United States and China could cut world economic growth next year, the International Monetary Fund, or IMF, warned today. IMF Managing Director Christine Lagarde said U.S. President Donald Trump's threat to tax all trade between the two countries would shrink the global gross domestic product by one-half of 1%. The warning came as G20 finance ministers and central bankers prepare to meet in Japan this weekend. They will gather just weeks after U.S.-China talks collapse amid claims of broken promises and another round of punishing tariffs. You've been listening to VOA's International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, and our engineer, Rob McLean. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.